Welcome to Co-op Radio 102.7 FM CFRO. This is Monday Brown Bagger. My name is Reginald Angus Argue. This is going to be archived on my website at angus-mcleod.com. McLeod spelled M-C-L-E-O-D. The guest I have right now, this gentleman has been emailing me some very interesting information in regards to United States and also in regards to the subprime mortgage fiasco and many other things. I'd like to quickly introduce our guest. With that said, I'd like to introduce our guest. He ran for the nominee for president for the Reform Party in 2004, and he is a New York businessman. With this said, I'd like to introduce Jason Pacifico. Hello, Jason.
Well, hi, Reg. How are you?
Well, thank you so much for the information you've been sharing with me. It just blows my mind how much money is actually being hidden in offshore accounts that you've been sharing with me. And we're talking about the amount of foreclosures that are going to be happening by the end of 2011 and so much other information. But what I'd like you to do, if you could quickly share with our listening audience, by the end of 2011, what is the amount of Americans that are going to be living in homeless shelters, and also how many family homes are going to be facing foreclosure by that date?
All right. Well, since 2008 and this year, 2009, there have been approximately 6 million family foreclosures. There are 4.3 family members per foreclosure, you know, moms, dads, and their 2.3 kids. So already there's been 6 million family foreclosures. Next year in 2010, they're expecting 4 more million, and in 2011, another 4 more million. So by the end of 2011, we're looking at about 14 million family foreclosures, or approximately 60 million people. Two-thirds, it's expected, will hit shelters. And that's another huge issue with the Obama administration. Number one, why doesn't he just freeze foreclosures? You know, whatever the economies, whatever, as he says, he's beyond ideology, whatever the ideologies are, why doesn't he just freeze foreclosures until the economy, as he expects or as he hopes or as he tells the public he's planning, turns around, unemployment rate, etc., and where these people can find work, whom are out of work, the reason for foreclosures. But most of the foreclosure victims, which I say the reasons were that they were moved into the subprime mortgages. How they got into these subprime mortgages, I think when I ran for president in I started in 2003, but when I ran, I think the subprime mortgages were about 8% of the market. They are now 34% of the market. And what they did, they moved up the FICO score requirements. Those are credit background scores that they do in order to see if someone would qualify for a mortgage. And they moved 34% of the public into these subprime mortgages, 9, 10, and 11%. And some of these mortgages, Alt-A mortgages, which they've dubbed liar mortgages, or the option R mortgages, which doubled and tripled. They had small print and so on that just drove people, you know, from being able to pay their mortgages. So those people, regardless of whether or not maybe their wife or maybe, you know, their primary income earner lost employment, or whether both the husband and the wife kept their jobs, they were moved out of the ability to pay for their mortgage. All right. Now, in addition, prime mortgages. Now, these are average, regular mortgages that people can afford, okay, that people got into a contract, and the lies, I got to say, the deceit, the deception from the Obama administration, which is subtle to some conservatives in the mainstream media, saying that these people got into mortgages they knew they couldn't afford. They bought too big of a house. They took on too much than they could afford. And this is the reason why the foreclosure rate has gone up so high. That's not the reason. The reason are the subprime mortgages, the Alt-A mortgages, and the option R mortgages. But prime mortgages now, because maybe one worker in a home takes two wage earners to support a mortgage these days, lost their job or had to get another job at a lower wage, got into trouble, they're defaulting as fast as the subprime mortgages. So that's the problem in the country. Prime mortgages and subprime mortgages are defaulting as fast. 4 million next year, it's expected. 4 million in the out year, 2011, two-thirds of which these people are going to hit shelters. Now, Obama had a $3.5 trillion national budget. And inside this budget, he ran a deficit of $1.4 trillion. Some states expect to hit 1.8, but let's figure it at $1.4 trillion. He spent a lot of money on a lot of programs. Well, what I find it astounding is that the Section 8 program, which helps people who are not earning a big income, it helps people with their mortgages. It helps people with their rents on their apartment who are not making much income. Well, that program was canceled under George Bush in 2007. It's only available for people who are victims of family violence, children that were victim of violence, for one, or two, people in the witness protection program. Other than that, the program has been put under suspension. They didn't fund it under Obama, and it's been on hold since May of 2007. So,
could you quickly, in 2004, when you ran for the president under a Reform Party flag, could you quickly talk about the platform you had, something to help small businesses where you could create 20 to 30 million new jobs? Because the Bush cost the United States 10 million jobs.
All right. Who costed a 10 million jobs?
GW, because of the practices under NAFTA and World Trade Organization and other international treaties. I was reading up on that a little bit.
Well, all right. Under the Bush administration, they lost 10 million jobs under NAFTA or the World Trade Organization since he became president in 2001. But under my platform, when I ran for president in 2003, 2004, I had two major platforms or two major proposals. One was a MAP plan. I'll answer your question in a second. I'll quickly describe that. The MAP plan, Mortgage Acromatic Plan, and there's a big dimension and dynamic in the word acromatic and how I planned both my plans, which I proposed would create 20 to 30 million jobs. But the Mortgage Acromatic Plan was a 1% mortgage plan. Okay? All right. The second major proposal, to answer your question, was the ESHLA plan. That was Employee Shareholding Luminary Actualization Plan. And that plan said basically this, that new businesses or businesses that can invest in new factories, new equipment, new offices, expand their business base, that whatever their investment is, on every $100,000 they invest, that as long as they hire, on every $100,000 they invest, 4 employees and make them shareholders in their company, that will take that $100,000 under the Federal Reserve Program I propose and create it to $800,000. So, for example, a company invests $5 million on a new factory or new offices and new factory. On that $5 million, we turn that $5 million under the multiplier program I propose to $40 million as long as he made 200 new employees, hired them, made them shareholders. Now, it was estimated, I said it would create between 20 and 30 million jobs. The media also said they agreed with that as well, an estimate of 20 million jobs in the country. Just to quickly discuss my mortgage plan, and, the whole issue, what backs the economy, what backs the jobs, what's the dynamic, the whole issue about capital, about currency, about, the old gold standard, today it's really vis-a-vis the oil that backs major currencies. But my dynamic was an interrelationship. Like achromatic is a light that is, which means a light that is curved in a particular way or a particular shape that you get a realization. And that was how I based the MAP plan on. And I took the multiplier. Now, at the time when I ran for president, the multiplier was 10 to 1 on all new currency created from the fractional reserve banking. Fractional reserve banking is this. The banks can pyramid their deposits in their fractional reserves accounts. If they have $1 billion in their fractional reserve bank, they can pyramid 10 to 1. So at a $1 billion, they can make $10 billion, and they can loan it out accordingly. Now, today, Obama and the G20 summit in London, they moved it up to 30 to 1. Now, that's the standard right now, 30 to 1. But under my MAP plan, I took 5-to-1, half the multiplier rate in the fractional reserve banking. And I calculated at an average interest rate of 5.5%, and I came up with a 1% mortgage plan, and that was the basis of my campaign, the MAP plan and the Escher plan in 203 and 204. And I had a lot of people around the country very interested in my campaign.
And also with the derivatives, we had someone on in the past by the name of Jake Towne, who's running for private citizen. He's running for Congress down in Philadelphia. And we were talking about the derivatives, and you and I are also talking about this on the phone. And you told us how you told me how it tied into Bush Sr., Bill Clinton, GW, and also into Obama. I was wondering if you could actually tell our listening audience the exact same information you shared with me.
Well, all right. I think my best example would be go back to the Reagan administration, and Reagan campaigned for president against George Bush. You know, that was a campaign for the Republican nomination. And, of course, Bush lost, and Reagan won the nomination. And Reagan was going to ran against Jimmy Carter for the presidency. Well, during the deliberations on who would be his running mate, he selected George Bush, the candidate who he ran against. Now, the deal, they struck a deal. Now, the deal was that his campaign manager, George Herbert Walker Bush's campaign manager, James Baker, the deal was that if they won, Reagan and Bush won, that he would make James Baker his chief of staff. And so Reagan won, and he made James Baker his chief of staff. All right. Well, by 1985, he moved James Baker to his Treasury Secretary. All right. And from Treasury Secretary in 1989, when George Herbert Walker Bush became president, he made James Baker the Secretary of State. If you go back to Robert Rubin, for example, Robert Rubin was Clinton's Treasury Secretary. Now, under Rubin, in 95 when he became Clinton's Treasury Secretary, they suspended repealed the Glass-Steagall Act by 1999. Now, Robert Rubin went on to become chairman of Citigroup in 1999 when he resigned, and he was also worked for Goldman Sachs for 26 years, and in 1990 to 1992 was his Goldman Sachs co-chairman. Getting into Lawrence Summers goes back to the Jimmy Carter administration. That's the current chairman of Obama's National Economic Council. He worked in the Commerce Department under Jimmy Carter in 1977 to 1980. He worked in the Reagan administration on the Council of Economic Advisors from 81 to 82, and he worked in the Clinton administration as Undersecretary of Treasury until Rubin resigned in 99, and he became the Secretary of Treasury. And the whole history with the financial derivatives and the Glass-Steagall Act is right here, retrospectively, how the whole market collapsed, how they instituted these financial derivatives. They put no regulation on them. The financial derivative market today is between $450 trillion to $600 trillion, and lots of company, what they did, they hedged their bets. They took these subprime mortgages and they securitized them. They made them securities and they put them on the stock market. And what companies did, they hedged their bets because they knew that these subprime securities would go down because a lot of people, because of the high interest rate they were paying on the mortgage rate, and that was the incentive to move up the FICO score requirements and push people into 34% subprime mortgages, was because they were going to make them investments, because there was no Glass-Steagall Act anymore separating investment banks and commercial banks. The investment and the commercial banks became one. So in order to hedge their bets, they went into the financial derivative market. The issue is so corrupt, it's unimaginable. But getting back to James Baker and George Herbert Walker Bush, when Ron Reagan became president, he made James Baker, his chief of staff. And one of his pledges, Reagan, was that he would not put anybody on his staff that was a trilateralist. Now, the Trilateralist Commission goes back till 1971. That was born under Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was Carter's national security advisor, and David Rockefeller. Now, the reason why they made this huge commission of interest in Japan, Western Europe, and in North America, namely Canada and the U.S., all the big elite players, forces, are part of this commission. Now, what happened, President Nixon, what he did, he took the dollar off a fixed exchange rate. Now, whatever they exchanged the dollar for, yen, for pounds, you know, for German marks, for rubles, whatever they exchanged those dollars for, they were on a fixed rate. So there wasn't a floating rate. The rate, like the stock market, didn't shift. And Nixon felt that American exports were getting murdered, literally, because the rate of our dollar was too high in proportion to other currencies, made our exports too expensive, exporting them into foreign countries. So what they did, they took it off the fixed rate. And what happened as a result, Euro dollars. Now, these are American dollars sitting in European banks. They're called Euro dollars. They crashed by 20 to 40%. So, like the Rockefeller interest, David Rockefeller lost billions, tens of billions of dollars. So, in order for this not to never happen again and they'd be ready for any market change, they created the Trilateralist Commission. Now, when Reagan ran for office, he promised never to let any of the Trilateralist Commission run his administration. Well, the foot in the door was James Baker, and the history's pretty clear. In Reagan's second term, they pretty much charged that Reagan was not running his presidency anymore, that his VP, his vice president, was running his office. George Herbert Walker Bush was running his office with Jim Baker and the other people they brought into his administration. In other words, when Jim Baker went from chief of staff, Reagan's chief of staff, to Treasury Secretary, who replaced him was Don Regan. Don Regan was the Treasury Secretary. He was also the former chairman of Merrill Lynch. He replaced James Baker as his chief of staff. So you can see how these interests kind of consolidated power, and even a guy like Reagan, who was against these big money interests running the country or running his administration or running the key branch of government, the office of the executive, that he would never appoint a trilateralist in any of his key secretary or in his cabinet positions, and it's exactly what he did. Now, Obama has 9 or 10 people in key positions that are all trilateralists, and they're really running the show, and they're running his administration. And, you know, I say again, why doesn't Obama, one, freeze foreclosures? You're talking 30 or 40 million people that wouldn't lose their homes, or right now 8 million foreclosures, 32 million people that wouldn't lose their homes and that perhaps would be able to keep their homes long term if he froze foreclosures. But he hasn't done that. He hasn't really instituted the Section 8 program, which helps subsidize people who may lose their jobs or their wages go down and fall into a particular category where they can get help from the government in mortgage subsidies or rent subsidies. Now, all the people that lose their homes, of course, they'll need apartments, you know, and whether or not they still have their job or not, whether or not both, you know, husband and wife have lost their job and end up in an apartment, they'll need help with their rent. Well, that program doesn't exist, or it's under suspension because Obama didn't suspend it. So all these things are working against the public. But I got to say, Obama instituted a modification plan. He said that he'll help all troubled homeowners who go into default or on the verge of default by giving them a 3 to 5 year modification plan where we'll lower your mortgage for 2%, and after that 2%, you know, 3 years or 5 years, we'll go back to the market rate to help homeowners who are in trouble. Well, you're talking like 14 million people who are in trouble right now, and 8 million people or 6 million people have lost their homes, but 800,000 people have qualified. Of the 800,000 people, only 6% of those 800,000 people, why isn't it 8 million people, are in the long-term program. The other is still up in the air in the temporary modification plan, and it's reported that every person that goes into the modification plan, half of them lose their home anyway, even though they went into the modification plan. Now, then reporting the meeting, I've been trying to find out myself why those half of the people in the modification plan lose their home. I don't know if they adjusted adequately enough the arrears that they owe, you know, 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, 6 months in mortgage arrears, whether they just, you know, amortize them over the 30-year mortgage where they don't, their payments are only a couple dollars more, or they, with their interest rates, even amortizing them over 30 years, their payments are still far less than under their subprime or Alt-A or option-on mortgage. So there's huge issues in the country, but the banks, the major banks, it's a disincentive for them to let people, and a lot of this through the banking industry is on a voluntary basis. It's not part of law or reform or new regulation. In other words, they leave it up to the banks, and a lot of it's going through the FDIC, the modification plan. So the FDIC, you know, talk banks into accepting these people. But it's on a voluntary basis. On the securities of these subprime mortgages, it's a disincentive to them to modify individual mortgages because they lose investments on these securities. They'd rather the people be default on, and programs like Obama's PPIP, which helps the banks buy up the so-called toxic assets and recover the monies they lost on the foreclosure of that home or the default of that home, and save or, you know, perpetuate or help those securities in the interest of these major investment banks. So the issue goes back to the Reagan administration, but certainly the George Herbert Walker Bush administration. Robert Rubin was also part of George W. Bush's administration as well. So it seems that Obama has taken the interest of the last three or four administrations, the interest of basically the Rockefeller family, the Trilateralist Commission, Goldman Sachs, etc., J.P. Morgan Chase, and really left the country in desperate shapes.
Yeah, and also we have to remember with Bush Sr., he used to run the CIA. He used to be in charge of the CIA. And when you mention Goldman and Sachs, also at the same time, Goldman and Sachs lent hundreds of millions of dollars down to Barrick Gold to open up this mine, third biggest gold reserve in the world down in Chile. And what happens is that Barrick Gold has yet to open this mine. It could be actually billions of dollars that they lent to this Canadian company. Now, the thing is that if this news got out to the stock market, that Barrick Gold is not fulfilling its obligations of delivering the gold, then what happens is this could cause the stock market to shoot downwards because there's a shortage right now of gold. So in other words, this is a manipulation. Ordinary people go to jail for hundreds of years for the stuff that they're pulling. And yet what happens is they're not going to jail. And with that said, I wanted to quickly talk to you. You were saying, before I get to the next question, I'd like to tell you quickly what's going on here in British Columbia, the province of British Columbia. What happens is we're having our government right now is handed over all our natural resources over to the bureaucrats, the gold commissioner's office, and the bureaucrats have in turn opened up a fire sale, and they're allowing our natural resources to be shipped out of our province in the way of rock to be made into man-made gravel and into cement. So you got two companies coming in, one by the name of Lafarge, who was brought in by the Trudeau government. The federal liberals brought them in to Canada. That's the biggest cement company in North America. And then you got Ashgrove. Ashgrove comes out of Kansas City. Now, both these companies have run into a muck down in Venezuela. And Venezuela kicked them out, both companies, out of the other country. And in turn, so what's happening here is that these two companies and their subsidiaries are shipping all these rocks down the United States to be turned into gravel and man-made and into cement and stuff like that, which in turn our government buys back and uses in bridges and in construction of buildings and a whole bunch of other stuff. Yet they fail to tell the government how many billions of dollars have been taken out of our province in the way of mineral that's in the rock. So we have massive tax evasion going on here in the way of corporate tax evasion, which could actually is taken from our public coffers. So I'd now like to get into the next question. And you're telling me how there's trillions of dollars right now being hidden in offshore accounts, which the IRS is going after at this time. The Canadian government has already, there's been 6,798 Canadians have recently come forward to declare $1.6 billion in undeclarable taxes assets that were hidden in this bank. We're calling the UBS Switzerland Bank, right?
$1.6 billion?
$1.6 billion for Canada. How much is it for United States that's actually being hidden in this bank account?
All right. This is $11.5 trillion. Unreported in some 55,000 accounts or greater. The major bank is UBS of Switzerland. The Tax Justice Network have reported this, and there's an op-ed piece in the New York Times March 14th, op-ed piece in regard to $11.5 trillion. So far, the Obama administration has recovered through the IRS about 4,500 accounts of the so-called 52,000 accounts, and I think it's about $50 or $60 billion. So why hasn't Obama moved on the $11.5 trillion in mass? Or, you know, he's going to war in Afghanistan, you know, while he's accept the Nobel Peace Prize, you know, his notion on human rights violations and exhortations and painstaking diplomacy and just wars is frightening. And you know, I say to myself that why didn't he go to war or impound this money, use every measure of force imaginable to confiscate, to impound the $11.5 trillion and charge them 95% in taxes and penalties and so on, and basically take the $11 trillion and put it into our government or pay off the deficit or so on and so forth. That's one issue. Robert Wolf, I think a month or two ago, he was in my Martha's Vineyard with Obama on vacation. They're playing golf together. Robert Wolf is the chairman of UPS of Americas, and I think, and he's also a counselor on Obama's Council of Economic Advisors. So that's one issue. The other issues beyond the $11.5 trillion, and why doesn't Obama just impound it? Or why does any president, current or future, impound the money? Is because there's huge economic interest, you know, i.e. the Trilateralist Commission, i.e. the Council of Foreign Relations, so on. But the other issue with trillions of dollars was this TARP bailout. Now, the TARP bailout started under President Bush. He bailed out the major banks, which was $700 billion. This was passed before Congress and signed by President Bush, and the $700 billion went to bail out the major banking centers. Now, 3 or 4 months before that, there was another bill passed before Congress with $350 billion to help bail out the troubled Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac programs, which are owned privately now. The number is a little over $1 trillion. And I think a month after the TARP passed, Bush pushed another $800 billion, which did not go to Congress, which was not passed by Congress. They just printed the money out of thin air, as they would say, and they gave it again to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. All right, so I think the total on the Bush, on the TARP, is $1.8 trillion, only about $1 trillion of which went through the Congress and went on to our national debt. Okay, now $800 trillion was printed out of thin air. Under Obama, if you count the whole $1.85 trillion, the number is $23.7 trillion. It's unbelievable. In the guarantees, $23.7 trillion. The PIP program, that program was started under Obama under a 10-to-1 multiplier. In other words, every $1 billion that the government put up, along with private investors, that they would make $10 trillion. Every trillion or every billion would be $10 billion or $10 trillion. All right. Well, the private investors would only have to put in 6 cents on the dollar on that multiplication scenario, and the first 50% in losses would come, the government would pay total, not the private investors. So you can compare the PPIP with my 8-to-1 on my Escher plan that I proposed when I ran for president in 2004, that you can see where one would help new business, would help the markets, would help jobs, would help entrepreneurship, would help new factories, would help, you know, trade and exports and so on, where this is just bailing out the institutions that have really destroyed the American people. You know, I got to say, when this country was born in 1776 or, 1789, when, the convention passed the Articles of Confederation, the convention in 1789, and the country was born, and the first offices of the government were literally on Wall Street, the executive office, the Congress, Federal Hall, and the Supreme Court were on Wall Street, and they were moved in 1791 to Philadelphia. Well, I got to say that one of the dissensions in the country, you know, being born out of the tyranny of the British Empire, was the Pledge of Allegiance, that they did not want to pledge to any flag because they thought it would connect them too much to all the wrongs of a disastrous tyranny and a disastrous republic, that the colonists didn't want to pledge to any flag, that the secular pledge was almost sectarian. In other words, from secular meaning non-religious, okay, media, symbols, and so on, to nearly a religious symbol or prayer. Well, the new country, the new government, said, well, the pledge means a home ownership plan mortgage. And so that's how the Pledge of Allegiance was born in this country, pledging to the flag, that we're pledging to ourselves, to our lives, to our homes, to our home ownership plans, to our mortgages. Well, they violated that in this country with these subprime mortgages. It's really that bad.
Yeah, my wife and I, we lived in the United States for almost 5 years. We had to live without a nation. I got indirectly forced to leave Canada and go in exile because of my past writing, and I can still continue to write, and I still continue to be very outspoken. But with that said, before I ask you the next question, I have to do a quick station ID. This is Co-op Radio 102.7 FM CFRO. You're listening to Monday Brown Bagger with our guest Jason Pacifico. And Jason, I wanted to quickly ask you about this this thing called the debit card trap, and you know, how does this costing all of the 50 states, like how much money is it costing everyone?
All right, well, well, the profits made out of it from the banking industry is $47 billion. It's astronomical. What it costs people, I don't have a figure. It's got to be in the billions and billions of dollars, but you know, what basically the debit card trap is, and there was an op-ed piece in the New York Times in regard to this debit card trap. Basically, what they did is people, when they open a bank account or in their everyday normal bank account, they get a little debit card. And usually the debit card they use at an automatic teller machine to get some cash real quick that they need. And the debit card over the years expanded where you can use it at department stores or at restaurants. As long as you had enough money in the account, the debit card, you swipe it through the credit card machine, would debit your account or deduct your account the money if it's at Starbucks for $2 or it's at 7-Eleven for $5 or $6 or $7 or $8 or $9 or $10 for a paper or so on, or it was at a restaurant for $15 or $20 or it's a supermarket shop, right? You know, it would deduct the amount, whatever it was, $2, $15, $20, $100, $200. All right, now let's just say you made a mistake in your calculations. You thought you had $20 in your account, you're at Starbucks, you know, or you were at 7-Eleven, you just want to pick up the paper and a few items, $5, $6, $7, you thought you had about $20 or $30 in the account, and because of a charge that came in, let's just say it was on the computer, came in, you ordered something on the computer, used your debit card, you didn't have that $20 or $30 in the account, you only have like a dollar in the account. Well, if you're in Starbucks or in 7-Eleven or in ShopRite and you swipe the card, it used to come up insufficient funds. Well, the banking industry in the last year and a half all of a sudden decided to put these people on overdraft privileges. The overdraft privileges they instituted without anyone's permission. And as part of the overdraft privileges, if they pay the overdraft, you're at Starbucks, you only got a buck on your in your credit card account, or rather in your checking account or your savings account, where you use your debit card, you only have a buck, maybe you thought you had 20, and you swipe it, and it's $1.90 for the Starbucks coffee, they'll pay the overcharge, or if it's at 7-Eleven, it's $8 or $9, you only have a buck, or if it's ShopRite, it's $10 or $15 or $20, they will pay that charge, but they'll charge you $33 on the overdraft. Now, let's just say over a two-day period, you think you have $20 or $30 in your account, and you go and you make 5-6 charges with Starbucks, at ShopRite, at 7-Eleven, so on and so forth. 5-6 charges still, and it totals. They laid out the banks $24. Of the $24, the 6 charges, they'll charge you $33 times 6. So, you know, I said to myself, I said, the writing's on the wall. It's unbelievable. I hate to use the word conspiracy, but, you know, to drive people out of their homes, to drive people out of the apartments, to drive people out of their way of doing things is so great that people who are maybe struggling to make their mortgage payment because of the subprime mortgages, or because maybe their wife or their husband lost their job and they only got one income coming in, or both people are working, but they had to change jobs and they have half the income or two-thirds of the income. They're just making their rent, or they're just making their mortgage, or they're not just making it, they're falling behind, that now they get hit with the debit card trap and overcharges. Now,
I hate to interrupt you, but we only got about 2 minutes left. So could we, if it's possible, if you quickly wrap this up and then quickly give us some contact information, because the next show, it looks like they're getting ready to come in here. So we got about 2 minutes left with this one.
All right. Well, you know, I think the country badly needs the foreclosures to be frozen over the next 2 years, and for something to be done, despite that there was some credit card reform on the credit cards, the usury rates with the overcharges are up to like 60% and so on. The debit cards could be up to 3,000% or payday loans and so on. That if they turned around, they dropped credit card rates to 2%, for example, and they dropped mortgage rates to 2% for everybody, froze foreclosures, that would be a start on getting the economy turned around. But just to quickly wrap up on the $23.7 trillion that I described, you know, from Bush's TARP to Obama's programs, that right now there are 55 million mortgages in the country totaling about $12 trillion. Well, if they took the $12 trillion from, you know, from the TARP bailout, et cetera, and just paid off for the country, or paid off half of the $12 trillion in mortgages, or half the amount, that would be a better way to preserve this country, preserve this economy, and to help the economy, because 70% of the economy is in consumer spending. But that's how bad the economy is, and this is how bad the interests are working for a ruling class elite. And it's really sad to say. I can be reached at my email address is best at jasonpacifico@earthlink.net. Anytime, can just drop me an email. I'll be very happy to answer your questions, answer your email, give you information, give you references, give you links, or so on. And if you want to interview me again, you can just give me a Buzz and set up a time and we can do another interview.
Yeah,
I appreciate the interview.
Yeah, there's so much information. I wanted to quickly, before you go, I wanted to quickly tell our listening audience one article that you should really go check out, which Jason pointed out to me. It's called Obama's Big Sellout. It's in the Rolling Stone right now. And the gentleman that wrote it is Matt, and I hope I enunciate his last name properly. Tybee?
Tybee, yeah, Tybee. December 10th issue this year, 209, Rolling Stones, Obama's Big Sellout, about the Wall Street interest, how he sold the country out.
Yeah, that was when I read that, I couldn't believe it, especially with that one part. We only got about 30 seconds left, but I wanted to tell the listening audience, or the part in there, where he was talking about the gross domestic product. And right now, there's some Europeans that want to start this sort of world government sort of thing. It'd be based on how much each country is putting out gross domestic products-wise. And right now, the United States would be control of that because of how much they're putting out right now. So that's almost one reason why Obama appears to be bent on destroying his own nation right now. It's just horrific that any leader could do that, but we're seeing it up here in British Columbia too, and also across Canada with many of our politicians. There are a few good politicians like yourself, Jason, and Ron Paul, and Dennis Kucinich and others, but here in Canada we have it too, but the majority are just not worth their time of day.
Decide to run for president, but I got to say, what happened in Copenhagen and on the greenhouse gases and the climate issues and so on, they did the same thing as I described in many of my emails on how the Federal Reserve was born, that their so-called opium addiction, that's i.e. Henry Morgenthau Sr., who helped create the Federal Reserve at the Jekyll's Island Conference, 1910, signed into law in 1913, that they did the same thing on pollution. And Lawrence Summers used to work for the World Bank in 91, and it's on the internet. You get on the internet and look. He said that
I have to cut you off there, Jason. I'm sorry about that. The next show wants to come on. It's Co-op Radio, 102.7 FM, CFRO, Monday Brown Bagger. Thank you so much for coming on. That was Jason Pacifico. He ran for president under the Reform Party in 2004. We're definitely going to get Jason on again in the future because he's got a tremendous amount of information to share with us.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the time. And if you want to give me a buzz again, we'll do another interview. That's fine.
Thank you, Jason.
All right, thank you. Bye.
Have a nice day.